From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. There's no denying we've got good music in the South.
Oh, life is bigger. It's bigger.
Now it's time to get on like Spike Lee said, get on the bus. Go get your work and keep your beeper chirping, it's a must. Did you want that dust? Cornstarch, familiar with that smack, man. The music is like that green stuff, provided to you by Sack Man.
And nicknames for the never stuff, the never stuff, the never stuff. So I left and no one cared. I cut my losses and grew my hair. And I stayed strong, packed team weak. I found my love, I found my.
All this hour, we'll talk to musicians about music. We'll hang with Atlanta group Manchester Orchestra, and Puddles the Clown picks some tunes for the Georgia playlist. And we always love to hear your thoughts. Who are some of the best Georgia musicians this year? Favorite songs, maybe? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. You may know my first guest, Rhiannon Giddens, as the voice of the string band, the Carolina Chocolate Drops. That group rose to fame with the hit Country Girl.
I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard. The living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family.
Rhiannon's second solo album, Freedom Highway, came out in February, and we spoke to her just before a concert this spring at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta.
Thank you. It's the first time I've ever heard Country Girl described as a hit, so that felt nice.
Well, you know, folk music is not a genre, at least in the United States, that's traditionally associated with African Americans. Most people who sing folk music or sing with a string band have been white in the past. Do you think there are still obstacles for people of color in this genre?
Well, I think that's, it depends on what you're considering folk music. If you're considering it the commercial, you know, resurgence of acoustic music that happened in the 60s, say with like Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. Yeah, it was overwhelmingly white, even though there were black folk musicians in that commercial world, you know, like Odetta and Joan Eddy. And of course, so many people were influenced by Lead Belly. So, you know, when you talk about folk music as an American genre, as an American thing, it's been heavily influenced and populated by African Americans, but the common idea of it is absolutely more of a white sort of singer-songwriter kind of thing. And so that perception is very challenging as a black folk singer to sort of have to overcome, because we have to have these questions instead of just getting to the music. We have to talk about, you know, why don't black people play the banjo, and why are folk musicians considered white? So it is a problem because it does get in the way of the history, which is very, very clear in what, you know, African Americans' roles have been.
Yeah, I would never ask you why they don't play the banjo. I mean, the first classical composer to include a banjo in a symphony was William Grant Still, an African American composer. But that, speaking of classical music, which is how you trained, right? You're a classically trained singer from Oberlin. That's another place in which we can talk about the influence that African Americans had, which was outsized even in classical music. And yet, when you talk about legends of classical music, you're almost never talking about William Grant Still. And I wonder if that has an effect on a musician. In other words, as a musician, how much does your role model, how difficult is it to find role models?
I mean, it is difficult, and they don't encourage it. You know, maybe they do now, but when I went to school, you know, the idea of Black classical music wasn't really a thing, and just knowing, you know, the giants who, you know, were classical pianists, the Serta Jones and you know, who's called the Black Patty, and, you know, all these people who were there, you kind of get there and you think, oh, I'm just, you know, sort of inhabiting this white world, and that's not true at all, you know, because in the beginning, after emancipation, I mean, that was one of the most sought after things was classical music, because that was seen as like the pinnacle of Western art music. So, you know, African Americans have been involved in that since, you know, since emancipation. So, or even before, you know, talking about free people of color in the North. So, you know, the thing is that we've been doing this stuff for a long time, and, you know, it colors, pardon the pun, you know, your idea of what your people do if you don't know that. You know, we are told in the narrative, there's this narrative of American music that's sort of told, you know, to everybody. And it's, you know, Black people contributed like spirituals and, you know, blues and jazz, and that's it. And it's like, it's way more complicated than that. You know, every American genre has been a combination of, you know, cultural crossroads and cultural influence, but so much of the core of so many American genres does lie within the African-American community. And, you know, even those genres that don't have much color today, like country or, you know, old-time music or, you know, even jazz at this point, you know, it is an issue because, you know, it does color, like, as a Black musician, you know, if you don't know that stuff, you feel like, I mean, when I was going into old time music, I was like, well, this isn't my music, but I'm just gonna like get in here because I really love it. And then I started looking at the history, and I was like, oh, what? We invented the banjo? What? You know, like, why wasn't I told this? And you have to seek it out. And then once you seek it out, you find this amazing history, which is actually much more interesting than the history that you're told. I mean, it's much more American. It's much more vibrant. It's much more complicated, you know.
And colorful.
And colorful, exactly. And inspiring in that way.
So then let's get to the music, which, you know, there's things that you're able to do with your voice, which I have to feel you owe to your classical training. There's, you know, even in the breakout performance of Waterboy, the ability to go from to crescendo and decrescendo the way that you do all in one breath, that takes some training.
Waterboy, where are you hiding? If you don't come right here, I'm gonna tear upon you. There ain't no hammer that's on this mountain.
How has the classical training sort of either helped you or has it hindered you at all?
No, I mean, it's been nothing but great. I mean, the only issue I had to deal with was learning how to use a mic. You know, and that was...
Yeah, because opera singers go mic-less.
Yeah, you know, our whole training is to not use the mic, and so I feel bad for my first band. They were very patient to learn how to use the mic.
Because you blew out their amps?
Yeah, but, you know, I'm very grateful for my training, you know, and I'm also grateful for the fact that it came later in my life. I didn't start out wanting to be an opera singer, you know, at 10 or 12, that it wasn't until I was in college that I really learned classical music and learned how to sing, you know, in that way. And I'd been, you know, singing with my family before that. So I had this pre-classical idea of how to sing. So, you know, when I started branching off and doing other music, I could combine what I had learned, you know, in the classical world and figuring out how to make that, you know, support rather than to overwhelm. Because, you know, there's not a lot of classical singers who can cross over.
Yeah.
You know, it tends to take
there,
up your
many
entire...
There are many that try.
Yeah, there are many that try and they don't succeed. And that is because, you know, to be, you know, a top singer, you have to give everything to that. And I was able to do enough at Oberlin. I did a lot of operas and some more at UNCG. I was able to, you know, really get that experience of being a classical singer and that I can still sing with the symphony. I can still sing in that way. But I wasn't... It didn't overwhelm me or overtake me to the point where I can't disengage. So I use you know, the all of the wonderful things that I learned, the breath control and the mouth positions and all that stuff to support this other kind of singing so that it doesn't overwhelm it. You know what I mean? So that it supports it rather than overtake it.
So this album in some ways is really different from your first solo album, and in some ways they're kind of all of a piece. And by that I mean that the first album you were singing songs made very famous by some really strong-voiced and strong-willed women. And in this album, you are telling stories of people going even further back in history. And what is this... I guess this desire you have or urge to honor those who have gone.
Well, I tell you, you know, I'm a woman of color in 2017, and when I read history, I'm aware of my privilege. You know, I'm aware of the ability that I have to marry whoever I want, to get whatever job that I'm qualified for, to, you know, be able to hold on to my children and not have to think about them being taken away. You know what I mean? It's like, it's really not that far away, number one. And number two, it's, you know, what do you do with privilege? You have to acknowledge it and you have to have a responsibility. That's what I feel anyway. Because we all have privilege in different ways, you know, because there's people out there today who don't have the privilege that I have. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There's people who are born in situations that are not as freedom, you know, giving as mine has been. So it's like, it's not only responsibility to other people who aren't as lucky, but it's also responsibility to the people who came before me, who sacrificed so much so that I could be where I am. And I feel like if I'm not using my position to tell those stories, then I am not being responsible. I am not, you know, paying my debt. You know, because like I get to wake up in the morning and not be owned by somebody. You know what I mean? I get to not worry about, you know, being accosted or being, you know, being forced or any of that kind of horrible things that, you know, all like so many of my ancestors had to deal with. And so I just feel like it's my job then to tell those stories. And I'm a musician and I've got this sort of unique background that means I can tell them in a way that maybe they haven't been told before, you know. And I really feel that way pretty strongly. It's like, that's why I'm here. That's why I'm a musician. I mean, I'll sing love songs cause I love them and they're great, but like, that's not my mission. And that's not the core of what I'm doing right now.
That's singer-songwriter Rhiannon Giddens. We spoke to her earlier this year before her performance at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta. Coming up, taking the cello out of the concert hall and into the rock concert. First though, we'll add to the Georgia playlist with picks from Puddles the Clown. This is On Second Thought.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There is no sickness, toil, or danger in that fair land to which I go. I'm going home. See my mother, I'm going home, no more to roam. I'm just going over Jordan. I'm just going over.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Most clowns invite you to laugh, right? Atlanta has one willing to share his sadness, though. His name is Puddles, and he's got a great set of pipes.
One, two, three, one, two, three, drink. Throw one back to I lose count. I'm gonna swing from the chandelier, the chandelier.
That's Puddles performing a cover of Sia's Chandelier on Fox's America's Got Talent. He won over all the judges, even Simon Cowell.
I never, ever want to know who you are, Puddles. No, but I mean this, because I have a real problem with clowns.
He does.
But you may have turned me.
Puddles the Clown is a persona created by Atlanta-based singer and bandleader Mike Geyer. But ask Mike if he is Puddles, and he'll tell you he follows the sad clown wherever he goes. He told us last year about his memories first meeting Puddles at a bar when he was working in Atlanta.
He showed up, sat at the bar, didn't bother anybody, didn't say anything. He just motioned for some, he likes to drink a soda pop. Every single one of them, the cola, the root beer, he tried the tonic, the soda water, and then once he had each one of those, he asked for a one drink with all of them combined, and I was like, I really liked his style.
And the rest was history, you might say. Mike and Puddles became inseparable. Mike says even though the character can get sad and lonely, he is able to bring a lot of people together through his music.
When he's performing, he can really just look you in the eye. And he conveys this emotion through song and his mannerisms. And people are really seem to be very, very affected by it. Some people get kind of squirmy about it, but he seems to be really resonating with a really wide, diverse group of people.
Well, we asked Mike Geyer to take a step away from Puddles for just a moment and contribute Mike's picks to our Georgia playlist. The rules are simple. He has to choose two songs written or performed by another Georgia artist. So here are Mike Geyer's additions to our essential Georgia playlist.
The first song I'm going to play is by the powerful Abner Jay. From Fitzgerald, Georgia. He was born in Fitzgerald, Georgia. It's called I'm So Depressed.
I was born during the hard depression days.
That's sad.
In July, South Georgia.
Oh, that's hot. I chose that song because the world is a tough, rough place sometimes, and sometimes you need an anthem.
At the end of the year, we had nothing. We had nothing. We had nothing but grasshoppers.
They had nothing but grasshoppers. Oh, my God. All kidding aside, it really is a gut-wrenching song. It's a really sad song about people that have had nothing. They're disenfranchised.
Oh Lord, I'm so depressed.
Can you feel it? Can you really feel what somebody's feeling in that capacity? I don't think you can. All I can do is have empathy and for them and do what I can do, you know, for them. It's like when I see someone living on the street, anything positive that I can do would just be a drop in the bucket, but I still should try.
Tell me how long must I wonder? Tell me how long must I cry? Will there be someone to wipe dry the tears from my eye? Come on.
He was a one-man band, instrumentalist, singer, was a one-man band. Abner Jay has inspired me to don't be afraid to change courses. Don't be afraid to quit and do something different when that calling comes in. The second song I want to talk about is Hearts and Jars by Hope for a Golden Summer, which is sung by the Campbell sisters. I think they're from Athens. Yeah, Athens, Georgia.
This sorrow in my broken brain was there before.
It's a really beautiful song, a lot of great imagery. I like the idea of hearts in jars. has some iconic references in it that that really resonate with me. But also, it sounds like a really personal song.
I rewrote creation, gave us all vaults in our chests.
It was written by someone who is completely aware of their foibles and took the trouble to write them down and then turn it into a song.
Tuck them tight into tiny beds to rest.
Wow, this is really serious. I'm gonna start getting misty thinking about it. Saying what a song is about, I think, is a slippery slope, unless it's specific. Unless in 1814 we took a little trip, I get that. But describing what a song is about, I think I only can feel what it's about. I can't describe what it's about. I only know how it makes me feel. It makes me feel uncomfortable. It doesn't ease my mind in any way. It makes me feel uncomfortable. It makes me feel introspective.
This sorrow in my level head was there before I ever met you.
A genre of music that sort of sums up Georgia is really tough. It's a lot going on there. There's brass band, there's old time music, there's shape note singing, from which kind of originated in Georgia. There's the lowlands spirituals and gospel music, which originated there. There's rock and roll, there's hip hop, musical instruments and perspectives from all parts of the world now are part of Georgia. It's a very unique melting pot of a state.
Now we can take out our hearts.
That's Atlanta singer Mike Geyer. The persona he created, Puddles the Clown, was a contestant on this season's America's Got Talent. He made it all the way to the quarterfinals. If you have a song or artist that you want to nominate for our Georgia playlist, call 404-500-9457. And for more of the playlists, visit gpbnews.org and then click on the GPB Music tab. One of the most successful and influential groups to come out of Georgia is the Indigo Girls. Since the first release in 1985, the folk rock pair has had multiple platinum albums and won a Grammy. Both musicians in the duo also perform as solo acts, though. Here's Amy Ray from her 2001 solo album, Stag. Amy Ray joined me earlier this year from Gainesville, Georgia. So tell me a little bit about your songwriting, because I wonder if you, when you're writing a song, how you know whether it's best served as an Indigo Girls song or as an Amy Ray Band song.
Well, in the past, I started doing solo music in 2001 because I was writing a lot of punk rock songs, and and I had a lot of friends that were playing punk rock, and I had an indie label, and I was putting out a lot of punk bands. So that was a very obvious differentiation. And it had more to do with who I was going to collaborate with on it. You know, as far as a writer, I'd write the song, and I'd be thinking of, this is going to be a great song to play with the Rockateens or the Butchies or Josephine Wiggs or Kate Schellenbach or, you know, some of my other friends, Joan Jett. And then when I started lately, you know, my last record was country, and it was traditional country and mountain music. And that was a little bit different, because Emily and I, we do write stuff that could cross over into that category. But we've never been in country music, probably mostly because we're so left-wing and we're gay, and it wasn't really a place that where you could find a place in that. It was more like Americana. But I think lately country has opened up a lot too, and to different perspectives and styles. And so what I did, I love traditional country music, and I always have for so long, and I was writing songs in that vein. And I just found some other collaborators that were, you know, like a pedal steel player and a guitar player and a banjo player, people that I really loved. And I was like, you know, I think I found my people that I can make this record with.
Good night, sweet tender. The veil is on the loom. Coyotes sleep. They sing a lonesome tune. All my life I'm rambling, and so you're in my stead. I lie awake and wonder at every bedtime tale. So keep those.
I think it's more like when I'm writing a song, if it's an Emily Amy song, Emily's not the same about this, but I really can hear her in my head when I'm writing, and she can be a catalyst for me sometimes, knowing what are the harmony parts that she might write, or the guitar or the banjo or the piano or whatever might go on it that she might do. So that's probably what dictates that. It just gets thrown into that category, and then I work on it in the light of in that kind of with that lens.
So what is it about country music that you say that you like? What is it about that particular genre that you love?
I love good songwriting, and I love storytelling, and I have to admit, you know, I moved up to Dahlonega about 25 years ago, and being around all those players up there, it definitely got into my blood, you know. And when I was younger, I had listened to country and southern rock, but was writing more in the folk vein. And when I got into Dahlonega, I was like, it just kind of started coming out of me, especially I think the gospel style. I really like old school kind of field recordings from the mountains, and that just, I love that storytelling, and I think that's what it is for me. It's just the storytelling, and you know, country and punk are quite akin to each other, I would say. Like Hank Williams and The Clash have a lot of similarities in their song structure, so it, and it's very populist, you know. Like, to me, the beauty of punk rock was that anyone can do it, and you just, it's three chords and the truth kind of thing, you know, and that's the beauty of country as well.
Oh, the rock is my foundation. Jesus is at the base. God is on the kid drum, and the Holy Spirit sings.
You sing full-throated, just you leave it all on the stage. And I mean, I always wonder when I'm hearing you sing, I hear you sing recently and I think, wow, how was she able to sustain that? Like, how can you give it all and then still be singing two decades later? How do you protect your voice?
Oh, it's that the giving it all part is just passion. That's kind of always what I've had on my side, even when I wasn't really very good at what I was doing. Because I was so passionate about it, I could get away with it. But I just, you know, I actually do a lot of stuff. I have this DVD that I swear by that was made by a vocal instructor named Melissa Cross. It's called The Zen of Screaming. And it was made to teach heavy metal singers how to sing without losing their voice. And it actually changed my life. I started practicing the warm-ups and sort of being a devotee to her about 15 years ago. And or maybe 12, and ever since then, I've taken just much better care of my voice, and I warm up religiously, and I try to sing correctly, and you know, I can still yell and scream and belt it out and croon and do whatever, and it's just doing it the right way to keep me from losing my voice is what I do. And so, and this came about after losing my voice a lot and needing some help and to figure out how to not do that, you know, because I would just lose my voice after three shows because I was just singing incorrectly or just yelling too much, you know, whatever, or talking too much after the show, things like that. So it's a lot of water and a lot of sleep when I'm on the road. And but now I have a 4-year-old, so I'm having to figure out how to what to do in that context, because you know, I sing to her all the time, and so sometimes I'll get onto my first show and I'm hoarse because I've been singing every night to my baby late at night, you know. So I'm refiguring it out again.
That's singer and songwriter Amy Ray. She's best known as a member of the Georgia-based duo Indigo Girls. We spoke with her earlier this year. Coming up, one of the best Georgia bands to see live, the Manchester Orchestra. First, though, cello goes pop. It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. Monday is Christmas Day. If you celebrate, we wish you a happy holiday. On Second Thought, we'll be away that day, and instead we'll bring you a holiday special from the Moth Radio Hour. Great stories and great radio, so be sure to join us at 9 a.m. on Monday for that. Atlanta cellist Nick Ogawa, known on stage as Takanobu, does not play in an orchestra. He produces his own ensemble with loops and percussive sounds to create thick, intricate soundscapes. You might well think that would be great music for a movie, and you would be right. He also writes music for film and TV, and we caught up with Takanobu this summer.
Hey, I'm Takanobu, and I'm a cellist from Atlanta. I always wanted to be like, well, first I wanted to be like a rock star or something, but now I'm, you know, accepting that I'm doing something a little bit more tame than that. But people would always say that my music sounded like something from a movie, which I didn't really think very much of until people started to ask me if they could use my songs in their videos or that kind of thing. And then I was just like, well, I might as well just start writing for that purpose.
You came and found me when I was alone in the darkness. In my time of need, I was lost in the abyss. Then you pulled me out and you built me up, but only for a time before it all gave up.
I find that the sense of space is very different in live performance versus film. Like in film, things can breathe a lot more. In a live performance, you don't want to lose the audience and have too much space. So it's kind of straddling those two different worlds. But it's a good way to think about music too, because it's, you know, you can get locked into just always being entertaining all the time and not giving people a chance to reflect. I grew up playing music my whole life. My parents had me studying Suzuki violin when I was 3. And then I studied classical music until I was about 18, and then just kind of got tired of the classical world and just wanted to branch out. And I mean, I love classical music, but I just didn't enjoy the orchestra structure and the audition processes and just the clamoring for chair position wasn't my personality. So I also just really like writing stuff, so to use the cello as a writing tool is kind of not classical, so I just branched away from it. First piece I discovered was this piece, Julio, by Mark Summer of the Turtle Island String Quartet. It just blew my mind because he was slapping the cello and doing all these kinds of like very guitar-y types of techniques that just sounded, you know, blew my mind when I heard it, because I was like, this is what I want a cello to sound like, or to, you know, at least be doing more far out things. And then I discovered looping, and I tried out a loop pedal at a guitar store and, you know, immediately bought it and kind of made that a primary part of my writing process. The cello is really conducive for that because it has so many different voices within it. Because you can, you know, you can pizzicato backbone to things and then bowed harmony lines on top of it and then kind of weave stuff in and out of it and layer it. And that's what I do. Exposition is like a primo example of how I'm using the loop pedal, just to build up stuff and take it away and kind of make it a little crazy and then bring it back to earth again. Cello that I had in my car. Thought I'd bring it in, play a tune. So this is Shady Grove, old Appalachian folk song that I learned. This was the first song I learned how to sing and play at the same time.
Peaches in the summertime, apples in the fall. If I can't have a girl I love, don't want none at all. Shady Grove, my little love, Shady Grove, I know. Shady Grove, my little love, I'm bound for Shady Grove.
That's Atlanta cello player and composer Takanobu. Now let's talk to more musicians who've written for the screen. Atlanta band Manchester Orchestra. Musicians Andy Hull and Robert McDowell scored the 2016 cult film Swiss Army Man with Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano. And if you missed that one, maybe you've seen them playing big festivals like Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, or Shaky Knees. The band's been going strong since 2004 and just released their fifth studio album called A Black Mile to the Surface. I talked with the duo behind Manchester Orchestra, Andy Hull and Robert McDowell. So what do you think, if you look back at the beginnings when you first got into the group, what name a song for me in the album that's like the farthest away from where you were?
Mm-hmm. On the new album?
Yeah.
On the new album from where we were then?
Yeah.
I
like, what's the most, the biggest journey?
I think a song like The Alien, where we're now able to have complex parts but contain them and not have to rely on dynamics and angst and...
Volume
to relay the emotion. We've learned how to strip away and approach with the less is more, but still hopefully achieve the same emotions.
Mm-hmm. Made a pact with you and God. If you don't move, I swear to you, I'm gonna make you. Do you need?
So you guys have stayed with indie labels. Why?
Somewhat, yeah. The first label that we started, our first label, I started it back when we released our very first EP in like 2005. And so we did a deal with Columbia Records underneath Sony that they would sort of buy or lease our record label and give us a budget to help release other records as well. But we still had a major label machine at our disposal to use certain aspects of it. We were always very weary of it at the beginning because all we'd heard were horror stories about bands signing too big a deals and then labels leaving them. And so we were really, we tried to be conscious and smart about what deals we were making. So we've really more found a way to hold on to the DIY mentality and the indie mentality, but we've also been able to partner with people who get that and have been able to give us, you know, a lot of great opportunities.
And Robert, what do you think that does for you to sort of steer away from the I guess music making machine that is, say, Columbia?
Well, I think that as the faster you rise, the faster you fall. And we're a band that we want to have 5 records, 10 records, 15 records, and
well, you have 5.
Yeah. Halfway there.
Yeah.
And I think when you partner with the right partner and they know that you're not looking for the biggest single in the world, you're looking for the best piece of art you can make right now, they kind of, they let you control it more. And it gives you creative control to make the record you want to make instead of the record that's going to be the biggest success in this small window.
So let's talk a little bit about scoring a movie. And first, let's hear the finale song from the soundtrack of the 2016 film Swiss Army Man. What is the difference in music making and songwriting for you between making something for an album and making something for a film?
Well, an obvious difference for this particular score that we did was that we weren't allowed to use, for about 95% of the score, we weren't allowed to use any instruments. So it was all just my voice or the actor's voices or Robert's voice. So that was kind of like taking a, you know, not wanting to go to school, like I said before, but that was truly like a master's thesis of relearning how to make music and relearning how new ways to create atmosphere. And that's something that was heavily influential for us on this new album, because we had to learn how to make music without words that conveyed an emotional kind of hit you in the heart feeling. And we also had to do it in the span of, in some instances, 15 to 30 seconds. So how do you make it a heartbreaking song in 15 seconds? And the score sort of taught us through over a 13-month headbanging on the wall experience how to do that and how to create these sort of sonic landscapes that we weren't really that focused on in previous Manchester records.
And it also, it was nice creating something that isn't the main art piece. You're adding to someone else's vision. And I would say for our pride, that kind of like checks you a little bit. So going into this album, we were very open to like, well, yeah, like bring that to the table. We weren't so gung-ho on being the alpha male in the room. It was a lot warmer.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hear another clip from that film. This is called Talk to Her. Shades of the Beach Boys there.
Sure.
and we can sort of hear your problem solving and how you got around not using instruments. But I wonder if you could ever see yourself, you know, you see, look at somebody like Danny Elfman, who said, all right, as soon as I started scoring movies, that was it. I was done with pop music. Hmm. Did you feel a sort of pull to do this again?
I think it more so influenced how we look at everything now. And for this Manchester record to really try and create an album within an album of sonic landscapes. And we wanted the album to sort of seem like a house where every different song is a room that you're in, and it's this different feeling. And we learned a ton of that from the score. It was very hard to do. I mean, it took us 13 months from start to finish to work on the score, so it wasn't something that we were like signing up for immediately. It would have to be something that we really believed in and cared about enough to put our hearts and brains into it for that long again.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with two of the members of Manchester Orchestra, Andy Hall and Robert McDowell. Then you just mentioned the new album, so let's hear another clip off the new album. This is called The Gold.
become my ceiling. I don't think I love you anymore. That gold mine changed you. You don't have to hold me anymore. Our cave's collapsing. I don't want to be me anymore.
So one of the great things about you guys is you sound just as good live as you do on your album. Like, nobody's going to hear your music in the album and then go to the concert and be disappointed. That pleases me as a musician.
Yeah.
But there are other people for whom that's, you know, that's not a big deal, right? I mean, like, for other people, the craft of sort of engineering the perfect sound mm-hmm. is the most important thing. And I wonder where you fall on that spectrum, whether it matters to you if a band or a singer can go and reproduce the same thing live.
I don't look down on somebody who can't pull off what's going on the album.
Because we've made records like that. Like, we obviously couldn't pull off the Swiss Army Man score. We've made solo records that there isn't a band.
Well, yeah, because you're layering your voice. But that's not exactly what I'm talking about,
right?
I'm talking about someone who needs an engineer to clean up the sound, to clean up the vocals. And
you know, if that person is a creative mind, you know, like somebody just totally outside of the box, what we're talking about, somebody like Kanye West, for example, is not a good singer, but has used technology and a ton of, you know, cool creative ways to make himself a good singer. I think that's amazing. I think there aren't any rules to creating music, and there shouldn't be any rules to creating amazing music. And if that means you have to put it through 100 different computers, as long as it sounds dope at the end of it, then you're in a good spot, you know? And I think technology now allows people to do that live and to recreate things like that with auto-tune, et cetera. For us, I think this just kind of goes back to our DIY roots and spending hundreds of days on the road for several years, the early part of our career. I don't know. I guess I just feel fortunate that we can sing and we can sing live. Because if we couldn't, I'm sure I would be using all the other tricks.
You just heard Robert McDowell and Andy Hull. They are half of the Atlanta band Manchester Orchestra. Their most recent album is A Black Mile to the Surface. And that's it for today's show. From our team to yours, we wish you a very Merry Christmas and a happy holiday season. For today and the week, this is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great weekend.
See you later.